It's the 24th of February, and we just finished exam number one. And yes, George.
Hey, can we send
out JPM after class? Okay, I get going. Assignments for chapter number four are due on Thursday. If you have any questions, stick after class, and we'll discuss those. Get them in. Get your old assignments in, and we are doing not so good. This is a pretty good start for the semester here, folks. Even Procter & Gamble's not giving us joy. But First Solar and Apple are flying ahead. And $5 is doing okay, actually. Oh, did you hear Walmart has agreed to give, how many, 400,000 of their employees a raise to $10 an hour? So, yeah, the market knocked them down. We're going to knock down your stock for that. I mean, how dare you give those people a raise? It's a rough life. Okay. All right, so now let's get started on chapter 5. Oh, boy, we're ready for introduction to stocks. Who's got a good joke? Anybody got a guess? Jane.
I don't have a joke, but I was looking at
Forbes.
And you know, the top 10, Walmart got 3 family members. And they're at $34 billion.
Oh, yeah.
They got 3 family members.
Right. The Walmart family is one of the richest families in the world.
They average like
$34-35 billion. Yeah, and they do not want... They are really upset about the fact that the state taxes. They're really upset that if they don't do something with that money, give it away, put it into trust, they're going to have to pay huge estate taxes. Don't you feel sorry for them? No, you don't feel sorry for them? So that's why they're paying the Republicans to do their best to get rid of the death. They call it the death tax. We talk about it in Business 121. You got some extras?
No.
2 more?
No.
Okay. Okay. Got enough? We have enough now? 1 more. Okay. Okay, so because we're going to start. So who's got a good joke? Well, here's a joke. This is from Will Rogers, who was a humorist in the middle part of the 20th century. He says, don't gamble, folks. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. And if it don't go up, don't buy it. You don't like that one? Well, he and his generation knew from where they talked about, because the Great Depression, folks, literally destroyed people's savings. They got hooked into the greed, and I mean, we think the Great Recession was bad, where stocks went down 50-60%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, and we'll discuss that in detail in this chapter, which was, you know, the biggest companies, went down 89%. Almost 90%. So people were just wiped out. And they were wiped out because of other things we'll talk about later on. So where does the term common stocks come from? You see, when people use the term stocks, and I mistakenly put just stocks on the handout that I gave you after the exam, the one I wanted you to put the... And some of you put in the description about preferred and common stock, and I said, okay, yeah, I understand, I screwed up. But when people say stocks, they normally are talking about common stocks. And we're going to discuss preferred stocks later on. Doesn't it sound like you want preferred as opposed to common? Wrong. You don't want preferred. No, you don't. Preferred are for corporations. They're not for individual investors. And we'll see why later on. We want common stocks. It has nothing to do with the fact, oh, they're commoners. No, the term comes from the fact that when these corporations were originally set up back in the 1600s in the UK and Netherlands, they were shareholders in common. Every share had one vote and was responsible for that part of the entity. Stocks are equity financing. In fact, you'll hear people use the term equities. Are you in bonds now? No, I'm in equities now. I think the stocks are a good deal. They enable investors to participate in the profits and the growth generated by the business enterprise. But one thing we don't talk about, and you need to know but most people don't worry about, is that you're a limited liability owner. When or if you take Business 120, you'll discuss business structures and why, you know, sole proprietorship, you and the business are one and the same, whereas a corporation, you're shielded. They call it the corporate veil. But there are situations where people, you try to use the corporate veil to shield themselves, and the courts can pierce the corporate veil. But when we discuss the companies that we're dealing with, that's not an issue. So you can only lose your investment. Stockholders receive, potentially, optionally, dividends and capital gains, or capital losses. Another word for capital gains is capital appreciation. Contrary to what many people believe and how many people behave, stocks are not simply millions upon millions of worthless pieces of paper that are traded back and forth. Well, now there's no paper. It's all electronic. They represent ownership in real business. Was that mine or was this one of you guys? They represent real ownership in real businesses. And we have a tendency to just, because we're immersed in this cocoon of technology, to just, you know, they're invisible. But the companies, I mean, think about what would happen if FedEx or UPS weren't around, right? You'd be waiting 7 or 8 weeks for the Postal Service to get around to delivering, and it's not because it's the Postal Service's fault, it's because they're not designed to do what FedEx and UPS do. Or just think of it, point to any place. Who's that? Who made that? Anybody know?
Honeywell.
Or maybe another company, but probably Honeywell, and I bet you it is Honeywell. And we go look at it, and it says Honeywell. And you don't even think about it, right? You just turn the darn thing on. So we are in this milieu, and they are there. Over the long term of modern finance, the return from the stock market as measured by the S&P 500, which we'll discuss in detail next on Thursday, has averaged around 10 to 11%. I tell people 8, 9, 10%. But in any one year, it is unlikely that the return will be 10 or 11%. The return has varied from a high of almost 54% in the 1950s to a low of 43.4% in the 1930s, and 2008 was one of the worst years, almost 40% down. And in any given year, folks, there is a 1 in 3, 1 in 4 chance that you're going to have a down market. Now, is it 1, 2, 3, down, 1, 2, 3, down? No, it doesn't work that way. In fact, between 1982 and 2000, it went in two directions, up and way up, and everybody thought, blue skies, productivity gains, internet, we're all going to get rich, 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 stocks will never go down. And then it went down 2000, 2001, and 2002, 3 years in a row. Kick, kick, and a punch right in the stomach. Oh, but as we saw in Chapter 1, and again, ignore the small company stocks, even though we do know that they have done better over the long term than large company stocks. We know that stocks are the best long-term investment if we can stomach the kick in the stomachs that we get every once in a while. And these don't look that big, do they? These little squiggles here? Why? Because this is a logarithmic scale. It's not an arithmetic scale. Every unit, it goes up by a factor of 10. And the idea behind a logarithmic scale is it turns a exponential curve into a straight line. So these squiggles are a lot worse than they look on this logarithmic scale. But here's a better term, a better graph. And this one's a little tricky to understand at first. What we're doing is we're going back to the Great Depression. And we're looking at rolling 10-year periods and how well the Dow Jones Industrial Average, whatever that is, we'll discuss it on Thursday, how well that has done over 10-year periods. And out of the Great Depression, we see that there were 3 10-year periods where the market was down over 10 years. You put your money in and left it there, and 10 years later it was less than what it was worth. But then, coming out of the Great Depression, out of World War II, we see that we had the go-go 1950s and 60s, and I know it might sound silly to some of you, but that was the modern era, and go back and look at some of the videos from the 1950s, how the new atomic age and the modern-day go-go housewife, And the stock market was rocking and rolling. And then finally, in the 1960s, people started saying, hey, stocks are pretty good investments, aren't they? And then bam, we had the 1970s. You see, it's the sixth cycle. Greed, fear, greed, fear. And then what happened in the 1970s? It wasn't disco. I mean, disco was partly responsible for it. But what happened is we had a culture war, Vietnam, the drug wars, the women's rights, civil rights, gay rights, Watergate, the first gas shock. But the worst thing, the hardest thing for the economy was the baby boom generation. This huge bulge of people coming out of the World War II, and all the servicemen came back, and your patriotic duty was to have as many babies as you could to beat those Ruskies. And they all needed jobs, and they all needed cars, and they all needed housing, and all needed shoes and refrigerators. Very difficult time for the economy. We come out of the 1970s, and now we have the computer technology, internet technology, and blue skies, productivity gains, and the market went in two directions, up and way up, and then whammo. The first internet bubble, and then the housing bubble, and you have to go back to the Great Depression to see 10-year rolling periods where stocks went down over 10 years. Yes?
What was the main reason that the dot-com thing happened?
Like, what was the main reason the dot-com?
Yeah.
It's nothing new. When you go back in history, you'll see that there are new technologies that excite the world and change the world. Don't get me wrong. The internet has changed the world, right? I like to tease people and say, oh, I'm waiting for that internet fad to blow over. Right? Good luck, right? But in the 1840s, there were 400 railroad companies. How many railroad companies are there now? Well, no, there's less than five. There's three biggies, and one got bought by Warren Buffett. So in the 1920s, it was radio. You've heard of Radio Corporation of America, right?
Yeah, RCA.
RCA, exactly, RCA. It hit a high of $290 in 1929, and then 4 years later, it was $2. And it never recovered. So, you know, that was the internet at the time. In the 1990s, some of you were just young, but the internet was going to change the world. Has it changed the world?
Yes.
But is AOL still around? Kind of, sort of, not really. CMGI, DrCoop.com, The Street, The Globe, all these other websites, all these other sites that are gone.
Is this because it became
your own website? No, it's because people they fool, and we're humans. We fool ourselves. We hear people say these things. It's different this time. The old way of valuing stocks are wrong. It's okay to pay an outrageous amount of money for this stock because it's never going to go down. This happened in the 1960s and 70s with companies that were called the Nifty 50. Go back and type Nifty 50. And that was the people believing that companies like Xerox would never go down. Or Polaroid. You ever hear of Polaroid?
Yeah.
The name will live forever. But the company's long gone. Now, I don't know about you, but I would not want to invest in a company whose name rhymed with hemorrhoid. Just not my idea of a good investment. But these companies, people would just bid up the prices and not worry about the valuations. And what, by the end of this chapter, and certainly the next chapter, you are going to understand valuation. And you're going to be able to identify companies whose valuations are richly valued and valuations who are on the low side. Now, does that mean you're right? Does that mean that the market price that company has is deserved? We'll know in 3 to 5 years. Right now, we can see that people are richly valuing a certain company, but they might be right. They may be wrong. And that's the problem. You see, that's the problem. But what I hope to do is tilt the odds in your favor so that you will buy stocks, buy companies that are reasonably priced and have a reasonably good expectation of future profits and future earnings and future dividends. It's not a guarantee. but it tilts the odds in your favor. Make sense? And when you do buy a GoPro or a Titter or a Farzbook, you will understand that you are speculating. You will understand that you are rolling the dice. And you might win, and you might not. You understand? Am I answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay. And look. Now, is this going to happen again?
Probably.
Someday, I don't know if it's going to look exactly like this, but someday it's going to happen again. People are going to... We're still in fear mode. You look on the internet, you look at different magazines, articles, and people are saying, yes, the stock market is wildly overvalued. We're going to say it's richly valued, but it's not wildly. It's not like it was in the late 1990s. Okay, traditionally, historical performance. This is something that's a little bit heresy to some people, but you're going to hear it often from me. Close to half of the return from stocks was from reinvested dividends. The cash, optional cash payments that the companies throw off, you know, they earn money and they can pay, they don't have to, but they can pay their shareholders dividends. So those dividends were reinvested. And stockholders used to expect 4-6% in dividends. This was as much or more than what bonds were paying in interest payments because stocks were considered much more riskier than bonds. So if we go back from 1936 to 2008, we see that the S&P 500, what's that? We'll discuss it in detail. We've already discussed it. We'll discuss it again. 500 largest companies in the United States were paying an average of 3.8%. Now, remember, some companies, the growth companies, don't pay any dividends. So some companies are paying 4, 5, 6%. But in the 1980s, 1990s, people did not want dividends anymore. And dividends fell to less than 1%. In March of 2000, the height of the stock bubble, we had dividends at 1%. So if you go from 1997 to 2007, the average was 1.5%. So it fell by more than half. The reasons given were varied. Dividends were taxed at a higher rate than capital gains. Yeah, well, that's not true anymore, thanks to George Bush. People wanted the business to reinvest the earnings for growth instead of distributing it to the investors. Yeah, that's true. People wanted growth. Forget dividends. I'm not interested. I want you to grow the company. Stocks were no longer considered riskier than bonds. Well, over the long term, the truth turns out that, yeah, they're riskier in terms of volatility, but in terms of opportunity cost, purchasing power, stocks will do better for us if the world doesn't end. Savings accounts, what are they paying now? 0.01%. And people lost track of their senses. And all these are valid. All these are valid reasons. But dividends don't lie. We will discuss dividends in detail. So here is a graph that shows you what happened from 1960. In 1960, stocks were paying a little less, there's that 3.8%, than what bonds are paying, 4.3%. And then we see the dividend yield go down as prices went up, and bond yields started to go up. What's going on? 1970s. Inflation. Inflation is the bondholder's worst nightmare because now the money you get back is worth less in interest. The money you get back in interest and the principal repayments are worth less. So bond investors started demanding higher interest rates. And inflation got out of control as the baby boom generation came of age and as we all wanted, me, I'm one of boomers, cars and refrigerators and jobs and shoes. And you see the yield on stocks go up. Why? Because the stock market was going down in the 70s. So the dividends were worth more. And then we see what Alan Bernanke called the Great Moderation. We had a president named Jimmy, folks. His name was Jimmy Carter. I don't know if you believe that, but he was a real president. And everybody was worried about inflation. He went to a gentleman by the name of Paul Volcker. And look him up because I think he still works for Obama. Paul Volcker told Mr. Carter, President Carter, yes, I can break the back of inflation, but it may cost you your presidency because it's going to cause a severe jump in interest rates. Probably a very severe recession, and there were two. Carter said, to his credit, he said, go ahead and do it, and he did lose the president, but not that wasn't the only reason. Iran-Contra later on. But what we see is the short-term interest rates were jacked up, causing a severe recession, causing the worst recession since the Great Depression until 2008, and interest rates starting to plummet. Interest rates starting to fall and fall and fall and fall. And as stocks started to get more and more exciting, and everybody wants stocks, who wants bonds? I want stocks. I want the dividend rate fall to 1% at the height of the internet bubble. Bond prices, bond interest rates keep falling. And yeah, well, if you had bought back then, you would have done pretty well in bonds. And look, here is the Great Recession. We see stock dividends going above interest payments. When that happens, folks, historically, it's not a guarantee, but whenever bond interest rates go below what stocks are paying in dividends, that's usually a huge bullish sign for stocks. It means the stock market's going to do well. It's not a guarantee, but sure enough, it worked out exactly as planned. The stock market took off in 2011 was a little bit of a hiccup, but we then saw, again, right before 2013, when the market went up 30% a couple years ago, that the bond interest rates going below the stock market dividends, and sure enough, the stock market exploded on the upside. And now we see that they're pretty darn close. But look at bonds. Look how low bonds are paying. We're going to see that bonds are... I mean, if there's a bubble out there, folks, it ain't the stock market, it's the bond market. We'll discuss bond prices, bond interest rates in detail later on. Questions, thoughts? Does this make any sense? We'll come back to it again. But this is what Alan Greenspan called the great moderation. If you had bought bonds right here, you made a ton of money. Because as interest rates go down, what happens to bond prices? It's a seesaw. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. Would you want to buy bonds right now?
No.
I don't. Doesn't mean I'm right. But I don't think bonds... I don't know. Some people say, oh, no, they're going to go down lower. Okay? The pendulum swings. The bear markets of 2000 to 2002 and 2008 have changed investors' perceptions about dividends. We now see investors and companies focusing more and more attention on dividends. Many companies that never paid any dividends are now doing so. I mean, you had Microsoft sitting on $60 billion of cash. Apple now has $140 billion of cash. They had cash coming out of their ears. They could buy all the car companies. Not all of them. They can't buy Toyota, but they could buy GM, Ford, and Chrysler and still have money left over. So what are you going to do with all that cash? Microsoft, they keep writing Windows, and they keep making it worse. They keep rewriting Office, and they keep making it worse. So what are they going to do with that cash? Now they're paying us dividends. Now Microsoft is paying like 3%. Yes?
I'm going to say they just announced that it's like double Exxon, which is the next highest.
Microsoft is more than Exxon, worth more than Exxon?
Yeah, Apple just beat Exxon.
From dividend point of view? Or the size?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and Exxon was the largest company for many years, but not always. Cisco was one. Oracle was once the largest company, but now Apple's the largest company. So the tax law has changed dividends so that they are taxed roughly the same as capital gain. There's it's not a very good book, but it's a wonderful title from a woman who's based in La Jolla, Geraldine Weiss. It's Dividends Don't Lie, folks. How do you know that dividends don't lie? They wrote you a check. Now, they don't write you a check anymore. The money comes into your account automatically, electronically. But that's cash in your pocket. Every other number on those financial statements that they put down could be a lie. And sometimes it is. You ever hear Enron? You ever hear Enron? You were young children. It happened 12 years ago. But for a while they were calling San Diego Enron by the Sea, because of the pension problems. Every single number on that financial statement, the income statement, the balance sheet, the cash flow statement, they all could be lies, except for this one, because they wrote you a check. So dividends don't lie. Do we love dividends?
Yes.
Yeah, I do. Do you know the only thing that gives me pleasure It's to see my dividends coming in. Now, this is attributed. We don't know if he actually said it or not, because his neighbors said he said it, so we don't know. But John D. Rockefeller. You ever hear of the Rockefellers? Yeah, that's the Exxon, right? It's the Standard Oil. That's where it came from. But supposedly, yes, the only thing that gave him pleasure was to see his dividends coming in. So what are the pros of stock ownership? How we do it for time. Am I going too fast? No? Okay, good. If I go, just go help. Okay, pros. Allows the general public to share in the rewards of the business enterprises. They have been, I should put financial, because the real estate investors jump up and down and say, you don't know what you're talking about. The real estate's so much better. Well, we'll discuss real estate later on. We should put the best financial securities investment over time, dividends and capital gains, easy to buy and sell, liquid investment, limited liability. You can tell people that. They'll probably go, huh? Yeah, they can only go after you for how much money you put in. But here's one that we don't think of. We are participating in a system that, so far, folks, it may be the worst system in the world for economically giving people, you know, food, clothing, and shelter, except for all the others, right? Socialism, communism didn't work too well. Some socialist countries really aren't socialist, they're socialist capitalists. But capitalism has been the best system so far. So we are participating in a system that has increased the standard of living for everybody. More, some more than others. We still have a long way to go, which is cool because for investors, that gives us a tremendous opportunity because much of the rest of the world is still living on a couple dollars a day, right? And a few dollars a day. We got to fix that. And that's what I think is one of the best parts about investment. But we don't care, right? We want money. But I think keep that in mind. Now, what's the con? Very volatile, very risky. And, that stock was really volatile. That means they bought it for $12 and sold it for 30 cents. Corporate and financial, hanky-panky. We'll just take a look.
What? Is that like the derivatives things that Chase and all those banks were doing? Or that?
Well, what they were doing and what they're still doing is stuff that, in my humble opinion and many others, banks shouldn't be doing. Right? That was after the Great Depression. There was if those of you who are interested in politics and economics, you might want to take a look at something called Glass-Steagall. After the Great Depression, there was an act that broke up the banks and the brokerage firms. And you might have heard of J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley. Well, the House of Morgan was broken up into three parts. The two parts that we still know about are J.P. Morgan Chase, the bank, and Morgan Stanley, the brokerage firm. Well, in the 1980s and 90s, there was a move to relax these restrictions. It's new technology. It's a new world. We don't need them anymore. And in 1999... Glass-Steagall was repealed. And then the banks got into things that they were doing before the Great Depression, and that's how we got, that's part of the reason, wasn't the only reason. A lot of it was just people believing that housing prices would never go down. And so the Goldman Sachs of the world, the Morgan Stupens of the world, the J.P. Morgan Chases of the world, and Wachovia, and who else? WAMU, Washington Mutual, they got involved in things they really shouldn't be doing because they're deposit institutions that are backed by the federal government, and that got us into this mess. And you would have thought, in fact, in 2008, I talked to a very, very smart person. This guy had been in the business for over 40 years, and he was a really well-respected money manager, and I asked him, they were giving a presentation, it was question and answer, I said, will we go back to Glass-Steagall? Will these practices that the banks were doing be, in your opinion, in your company's opinion, your opinion, will they be prohibited? And he said, absolutely. Absolutely. That was in 2008. It's 8 years later. It's 7, 8 years later, and they have not. They're still going on. That shows you how strong the bankers are, folks. How much clout they have on the in the Washington. Did I answer your question?
Kind of.
Okay, after class, I'll get to it. All right, here is volatility, folks. This is 2014. So you put in $10,000 because 2013, folks, was awesome. The market went up 30%. Right? So you talk to your buddy, you put $10,000 in the year before, and now he's got $13,000. And oh boy, aren't you greedy? Aren't you? I'm not greedy. Now you want to participate in the growth of the economy. So you put in $10,000, and within a month, it's down to $9,500. So what do you do? You keep it in, but you're going to lose more. No, you take it out because that's the prudent thing to do, only to have it jump back up again. And so you put it back in, and then what happens? It falls again, and then you're in the
That's the mistake
that
everybody makes.
Not everybody, and you won't do that, right? Nod your head yes.
I know.
You say that, don't you? But boy, when it's going down, don't you feel like running? Everybody run that way. What do? You run the opposite. Good. I'm glad to hear that because that's not what most people do. We're hardwired to run with the crowd. We're social animals.
Yeah, but at the same time, how can you predict things like what happened in 2008? Like, my aunt, she just took it out. Because she had a feeling, right, that she wouldn't have done that.
When did she take it out? At the bottom or before it fell?
Like right before it.
Well, you see, then when did she put it back in? Yeah, you don't know when she put it. It's still sitting there, right? Yeah. So yeah, it's tough. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. You're going to exist. You're going to experience these. But one of the cool things about dollar cost averaging is. What do you care? Right? It goes down, no problem. Another $50, $100 goes in. It goes back up, oh well. Goes back down again, another $50, $100. As long as you have a long-term time frame. If you need that money in 3, 6, 9 months, do you want it in the stock market? Everyone should say, hell no. Wait till I ask you. Do you need the money in 3, 6, 9 months? You want it in the stock market?
No.
Hell no. No. Okay. How are we doing for time? Little Brick, want to just stretch? Any questions? Any thoughts? All right, so how are we doing? We're doing pretty good. Because what we're going to do now is we're going to start discussing the different markets, the different places that stocks are traded. And what we're going to find is that the world is changing at breakneck speed. And the changes, you know, they're just every year something just hits you and you think, wow, you never would have thought that. The primary market is the market in which news issues of securities are sold to the public. You have probably heard the saying or the phrase IPO, initial public offering. And you hear about a new company going public, and the book in Chapter 5 describes this in detail. If you take the Series 7, you're going to have to know this process inside and outside. But I am here to tell you that most of us retail investors should not participate in the IPOs. Benjamin Graham said it best. IPO stands for it's probably overpriced. You like that? It's probably overpriced. Or imaginary profits only. You don't like those? Well, these are stock jokes. And so my recommendation is to stay away. The secondary market, this is where the vast majority of transactions take place. This is when people talk about the stock market, they're talking about the secondary market. So let's discuss the differences. The primary market, why would you want to go public? If you just started a company, and you are now thinking, well, maybe I should go public. Why do you do it? Because you're going to raise cash. You're going to raise money to start or expand a business or to help pay for ongoing business expenses. Many of the companies based here in San Diego are these high-tech biotech companies, and they need hundreds of millions of dollars to put their products out there. So they're continually having initial public offerings and secondary offerings. Once a company becomes large enough, it is just expected that they will go public. And it's just, well, it's what you want to do, isn't it? Some companies say no. No. There are companies that are sufficiently large that certainly could be public that aren't. Some of the biggest ones? What's the large? Anybody know what the largest selling candy bar in the United States is? No. Snickers, right. Snickers. M&M's. Mars. Snickers is the largest. I have a hard time believing that. Snickers. But Snickers is the biggest selling candy bar. And M&M's. And what else did they make? Mars. The company Mars. Mars bars. They are still a private company. And have been for decades. You can buy stock in Hershey, but you can't buy stock in Mars. Another company, In-N-Out Burger, is still private. And if you're interested in case studies of what can go wrong when the original owners pass away and the family starts fighting, take a look at In-N-Out Burger's history, because there was a family feud about the direction of the company, where it should go after the original owners had passed away. But most companies, once they get sufficiently large, are going to go public. Why? Because the people who started them become instant millionaires. In some cases, instant billionaires. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, when they went public, his tax bill to the state of California, not to the Fed, his tax bill to the state of California was $1 billion. The tax bill. Okay, so think about it. Okay. So, and also, once a company becomes sufficiently large, how do you divvy up the spoils? You know, if you were one of the people who started GE or Coca-Cola, you know, how would you parcel it out? And so stocks allow us to do that. Make sense? What? $1 billion in taxes. I mean, he's worth, I don't know, tens of billions of dollars. I don't know. Ask him. He'll tell you. Okay. Did you know he can speak Mandarin Chinese? That was a brilliant move. He probably had somebody come in every day, 2 or 3 hours. What? Oh, his wife is Chinese. That's where okay, I didn't know that. Okay, but I thought that was brilliant because, you know, they're looking at China and saying there's 1.5 billion, 1.3 billion people there. We want to make them. Do you have a Facebook page? Do you have a Facebook page? I do. And the only reason I did it is because I didn't want somebody grabbing Wonder Professor and then having confusion. On my Facebook page, it says, I do not use Facebook. Do not call you. Please contact me versus me, my website. Here's my email address. I have 39 friend requests. Good job. It says, I do not use Facebook. Most of the people don't even know who they are. Okay. The corporation does not have to pay the money, folks, but it is now a public entity. Because you buy the IPO, doesn't necessarily mean somebody else is going to want to buy your shares, unless it's a Facebook or a Twitter or a GoPro. The corporation, though, now is a public entity. And as such, it now has rights and responsibilities that private companies simply don't have. If you went to Mars and said, how much money did you make last year? They'd look at you and say, who are you? Are you the IRS? We don't have to tell you that. But if you go to Hershey, they'll say, okay, here's our 10K, here's our 10Q that we filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It tells us how much money we made, how much cash we have, what are our expenses, what are our depreciation, and all those other things that we're going to take a look at in a few weeks. They must have one public meeting annually. This is a cute story about SDG&E. The parent company is called Sempra, one of the biggest companies based here in San Diego. And they used to have their annual meeting here. I mean, they probably still do now. But in the late 90s, they made some really boneheaded maneuvers and lost a lot of money. And they used to have their annual meeting here where the locals who owned their stock would come up and yell at them, and you goofballs, you idiots, you dumb. So they said, okay, we'll fix your wagon. They moved the annual meeting to London, one of the most expensive cities in the world. And they said, okay, come on, have a good time. Be the citizen of London and tell us how stupid we are. Chapter 5 goes into much detail about IPOs. As we said, IPOs usually do not live up to their expectation. The typical IPO loses 50% of its value in 1 year. Facebook was one such IPO. It came out at 38, and then promptly drop to 20. Now it's back up, but how would you like losing 38? Now, it didn't take a year for it to fall. It fell quickly and then recovered quickly. But stay away. In my humble opinion, you might decide otherwise. Now, the secondary markets. These are the markets that we're interested in. We're interested in the secondary markets. And the secondary markets, sometimes you might, I think maybe once I heard it called the aftermarket, so I don't know. But that's what it's also called, the aftermarket. They provide liquidity, an easy method for transferring ownership of your stocks, and a mechanism for pricing, an efficient mechanism, so providing the market is large enough for valuing your security. So someone says, "Hey, I got 100 shares of IBM. What are they worth?" Well, you go, "What are people selling, buying them for? What are people selling them for?" It's very efficient. When people talk about the stock market, they're talking about the secondary market. What were the two different types? And I say what were, because these comparisons are outdated. It used to be that you had what were called the exchanges. And they still call them the exchanges, but they do not work the same way. And then you had what was called the over-the-counter market. But the truth is, the differences between these have all but been erased. And so we will go through them. And I hope I don't go too quickly. If I do, just scream and holler. But it used to be that the securities exchanges were the place. And these were the videos you saw, the people running around screaming and hollering at one another and making wild gestures. And it looked like chaos from a distance. But when you got down there, you see it's basically just a big swap meet. And they're just buying and selling stocks. They're buying and selling securities. The same thing is true for bonds and other types of securities. But that's gone. That's gone, folks. It is all online. And the original OTC markets, they called them widely scattered telecommunication networks. Well, when they said telecommunications, that's what they meant. It was a telephone. Guy would look at somebody. Oh, this guy's got something. He's in Minneapolis. He called Fred in Minneapolis. "Hey, Fred, you got 100 shares of butterfly.com? "Yeah, I got 100 shares. How much do you want for $25? "Ah, screw you!" And then he'd hang up the phone on them and call him back 5 minutes. "I'll give you $22. "Ah, screw you!" These people would take lessons in how to be rude to one another. And that was part of the culture, right? But now that's all gone. It's all online. So the differences between the two have all but been erased. But let's discuss the differences. Historically, on the trading floor of the exchanges, all trading was done using what is called a double auction. Now, you're used to. Now, we probably will do it Thursday if we have enough time. I'm not sure. We should. We'll do a market simulation. One of the handouts I gave you on the back, the back of the scramble sheet is the market simulation. Well, I have extras on Thursday, so don't worry. You're used to a single seller, multiple buyer. If you go to a farm auction or a car auction, there's one person yelling out the prices and multiple bidders usually in the audience who are saying, "Yeah, I'll buy that, I'll buy that." But that's not what happened on the exchange floors. There were multiple buyers and multiple sellers, all at the same time yelling out prices at what they will buy or sell a stock. You understand? And it looked like chaos. And we'll see it. We'll see it. We'll see a video on Thursday. But due to both technology and the sheer massive volume of shares traded, things have changed. Almost all of the trading is now conducted electronically. Some large trades still involve human interaction. You still see a few people doing deals on the floor. But I think the reason they keep them open is just for television. I think it's a base so they can show the zoom in on the clanging of the bell when they start it. But I don't know. Far less than 1% of all transactions involve human interaction. The biggest exchange was the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE. Some people call it the NYSE. I think that's kind of silly, but that's what people call it. The big board. And this was, folks, this was a private membership. The first woman was introduced was allowed to join in 1966, I think, the 60s, the first person of color in the early 90s. It was responsible for over 90% traditionally of the volume of transactions on the exchanges. About 1,900 companies as of January 2015, about $20 trillion of market capitalization. These were the largest, these are the most prestigious traditionally, but not anymore. I mean, they still have some of the biggest companies in the world, but the biggest company in the world is no longer on the New York Stock Exchange. It's now on the NASDAQ. It was established in 1792 when Wall Street was actually next to a wall in Manhattan, but that's not true anymore. If the company does not continue to meet stringent requirements about how many shareholders and how large the company is, they ask them to leave. Kodak, Kmart, they say, we are going to delist you. You're no longer welcome on the New York Stock Exchange. That happened. But the last 20 years have seen changes that if you, a little over 20 years ago, in 1992, at the 200th year birthday, they had a big shindig in 1992, if you had told these folks that the next 20 years you would see changes that more changes than in the first 200 years, they would have thought you were quite insane. But no, with the internet and with the NASDAQ growing, we'll see the NASDAQ in a bit, they started trying to do all these things to adapt. They purchased the Archipelago Electronic Exchange. What is that? A few slides later. They bought the Pacific Exchange. They became a publicly traded corporation. No more partnership, membership only in the boardroom. They merged with Euronext Electronic Exchange, trying to go overseas. They phased out the face-to-face double auction trading in favor of almost, I should say, almost exclusively trading electronically. But as I said, there's a few people still on the floor. In 2011, folks, Germany's stock market, which is based in Frankfurt, their big one is based in Frankfurt, tried to purchase the New York Stock Exchange, the Börse. It's called Börse, I can't say it right. But they were blocked, not by the United States regulators, by the European regulators, who said that's not enough competition. And then, in 2013, they were bought. The New York Stock Exchange was bought for $11 billion by a 13-year-old derivative trading firm from Atlanta, Georgia, called the Intercontinental Exchange. So they are no longer the big board. They are no longer the institution of choice. You understand what's happening? Why? Technology. Technology is just blowing the whole system apart. It's just throwing a big bomb in there and seeing what happens. Take a look at some of these. The End of the Street. There's a pretty good article by The Economist, which is an excellent. What? No, some of the companies are quite good, and some of them are not. But it's just that the prominence and the prestige at the New York Stock is gone. It's just not there anymore. It's a whole different world, and that's because of technology. The floor brokers, the independent brokers, the house brokers, these are the people you saw running around. They all had different type of, different colored jackets on. And they would. It was all paper, and then they had these little devices that they could just zap at one another. And now they're all gone. They're in front of a computer sitting somewhere. They're on New York, and maybe they're in Atlanta, and maybe they're in Chicago, maybe they're around the world. Doesn't matter. The floor brokers were very worried that the aggressive moves by the New York Stock Exchange to all electronic trading meant the end of their way of life. But it really wasn't the end. It's just a big change. Does this sound familiar to any of you? Yes. What else is being changed at breakneck speed? Name one. Well, if you were taking this class online, you'd immediately understand what I'm talking about. But I like, no, don't get me wrong, I love the traditional classroom. This is my favorite class to teach. I get excited. Does it look like I do? Yeah, right. But guess what? There's a whole other class where I'm sitting in front of my computer. I'm giving the same lecture I'm giving now. I got to act like there's a bunch of people out there and entertain questions, even though there's no questions. I ask the questions. And then those people are sitting in front of a computer or their handheld device, and they're listening, they're watching. You see? Technology is not only changing the New York Stock Exchange and the brokerage world, it's changing education. And I'm not particularly happy about it, but I ain't here for me, I'm here for the students, right? I'm getting paid to help the students, I'm not getting paid to help myself. So education is being changed in a big way by technology. The specialists. We're going to see some specialists in a video on Thursday. These were members who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialist was to manage the process, was to keep it going. And the idea is, we say, to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. The idea was if all the sellers disappeared, their job was to step up and sell. And if all the buyers disappeared, their job was to step up and buy. They were what are called in the other world market makers. The role of the specialist is being squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They are becoming less and less involved in the typical trading day. They are now being replaced by what is called designated market makers. And they got that term from the NASDAQ, as we'll see in a few slides. Another term they use is supplementary liquidity providers, which sounds highfalutin, but as I said, their job is to make sure that the process keeps moving. If all the buyers disappear, they're supposed to stand up and buy. If all the sellers disappear, they're supposed to stand up and sell. And it may seem very altruistic, you know, they're doing it for the good of the market, but no, they're trying to make a buck just like everybody else. And so check out what Investopedia has to say about them. Market makers. They're often called dealers. Well, we should get to it in just a few slides. Hang on. Yeah, let's write that down. Specialist is the term that we always used on the New York Stock Exchange, but we're going to find out that the NASDAQ used the term market makers. And this term is becoming more popular. Another term that we use is dealers, not brokers. Brokers act as intermediaries, but dealers keep an inventory of the stock. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I'm sorry. I'll let's keep going. All right. Now, the Amex is no longer called the Amex. It is now called the NYSE MICET. NYSE MICET. MKT? Market? You think that's what it means? Market? Where's the R? I don't understand. Anyway, the Amex started... It's called, some people, not many people, they're all dead, but some people used to call it the curb because they started out on the curb. They would look in the window of the New York Stock Exchange, see what was going on, and they would trade outside on the curb. You know how cold it gets in the winter? How hot it gets in the summer? They got their own building a few doors down the street, but then eventually they were always very small compared to the New York Stock Exchange, 4% or so, 3%. But what they saw, the handwriting on the wall, they saw the NASDAQ getting huge. The New York Stock Exchange was already huge, and they're staying small. So they started concentrating on securities other than stocks. Remember the ETFs that we talked about, the exchange-traded funds? They were first traded on the Amex. They were purchased by the NASDAQ in 1998, and then the NASDAQ kicked them out the door in 2004, and then the New York Stock Exchange purchased them in 2008 and changed the name to New York Stock Exchange MICET. And they didn't even tell us brokers. I noticed it by accident. I called my boss and said, did you know the Amex is now called the New York Stock Exchange NKT? He goes, no. You know, something like this 20 years ago, this would have been ballyhooed in the media. Everybody would have known about it. But they didn't even tell us. Who cares? Nobody cares. As we said, the New York Stock Exchange, MICET, the Amex, was the first place that they introduced the ETFs. And then the regional exchanges. Again, very small, 4% of the volume. Chicago, Philly, Boston is the only one that was two places. Pacific was in L.A. and San Francisco at the same time. But they're supposed to be centralized places. Figure that one out. Boston, Denver. Denver was the one that was... You know, you don't want to buy something on the Denver Exchange. No. That was where the unscrupulous companies were listed. But look, they have started to differentiate themselves. The Philly Exchange started dealing with semiconductors. So often when they want to see how the semiconductor world is doing, they'll go look at the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index. And then the NASDAQ bought the Philadelphia Exchange. The New York Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange. See what's happening? The merge, the urge. See how big they can get? Now, the options and futures exchanges started in Chicago, which made sense historically, because that's where lots of the meat came through, and the poultry, and the wheat, and all the soybeans came through there. They have their own exchanges, but now options and futures are traded in all the other places. The OTC. I'm sorry if I'm going a little too fast, but I want to finish this up. I'm going to try to get to slide 31, 32, okay? See if I can do it in 5 minutes. If I go too fast, please yell and scream and holler. Now, the OTC, actually, that term is... Some people like the NASDAQ, they don't even want to hear that term. They don't want to hear OTC. Because the OTC system has some places where unscrupulous companies are traded, the penny stocks. And they're called the bulletin board, and it used to be called the pink sheets. Now it's called the OTC Markets Group. It looks from at least their websites that they're trying to clean up their act. But this is the place where thousands of these companies that are not real companies, some of them are companies that have hit on very hard times and never quite made it big, or once were big and now are poop. But most of them are just scams. And we'll discuss those when we get to penny stocks. But the NASDAQ is the big boy on the OTC. And as we said, they don't even want to be associated with the OTC anymore. You use the term OTC and they say, no, we're the NASDAQ. That's all they want you to think of, is we are the NASDAQ. So let's take a look at the dealers. In the exchanges, you had the brokers yelling and screaming at one another. And when things didn't go well, the specialists jumped in. But there were... They didn't have that face-to-face. It was all online. First, it was just people calling each other up. And so what you have on the OTC are what are called market makers. Another term is dealers. These people keep an inventory of the stock. That's their job. And they buy and sell it. So you go to your broker, and your broker says, okay, you want to buy 100 shares of Frunebulax or whatever it is. Oh, it's listed on the bulletin board. Are you sure you want to buy this company? Oh, yeah, my brother-in-law told me it's a good company. Okay, your broker will say. And so you go to your broker, finds one of the market makers, and says, we want to buy 100 shares. And the market makers are saying, this is my asking price. If you wanted to sell those 100 shares, you'd get the bid price. And I know it's hard to remember ask versus bid, but if you think of ask, if you have to ask for it, that's the price you get. It's the retail price. Whereas the bid price is the wholesale price. And the dealers make their money off of the difference, the spread. Does this sound familiar to anybody? No, I don't know. Well, yeah, I guess it's gambling. It depends. But you go down to TJ or San Isidro? Yeah? What do you see? What? Lots of kids. You see that here too. Mexicans. You see them here too. You see them here too. No. What you see are these little casas de cambio, right? At the money exchange centers, and they're going to buy and sell pesos and dollars. So they keep an inventory of pesos and dollars, and they throw up their what they'll buy the dollars with and give you in pesos. But if you want to turn around and give your pesos to them and get dollars, you get the same price. No. And how do they make their money? They make their money off of the difference. Make sense? And that's how the OTC got started. But now that's how all the things are working, folks. There's no more double auction. People are online just typing in what they will buy and what they will sell it for. So the dealer makes money off of the spread. The broker makes money off of the commission. You see the difference? Okay, so how are we doing? Not bad. So what we'll do now, let's finish this last slide, and then we'll do a review on Thursday, because we want to get through this. NASDAQ stood in the path for National Association of Securities Dealers automated quotation system. You don't have to remember that because NASDAQ doesn't even want you to remember that. They don't even want you to know that that's what it was called. They just want you to refer them as a NASDAQ. And yes, it's all in uppercase, and I hate that, but that's the way it's supposed to be. If you don't put it in uppercase, the spelling checker will say, no, it's supposed to be all uppercase. The National Association of Securities Dealers is now defunct. It is no longer in existence. It has given up that role as the self-regulatory agency that watched over the brokerage firms. It is now simply taking a care of the NASDAQ. That is now done by an entity called the FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And this used to be the arena for small companies that got started, bona fide real companies, throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And once they got large enough, it was just expected that they would move to the New York Stock Exchange. You see? It was just that what was done. But then a funny thing happened. Companies that you may have heard of, like Apple and Microsoft and Oracle and Intel, mostly tech companies, but not all, Starbucks, Costco, we're very happy on the NASDAQ. We're going to stay on the NASDAQ. And can you imagine at the 33rd floor of the Wall Street in the boardroom, the two words that they said, the first one was O. Exactly. And now it's a two-horse race between the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. And this is where we'll pick up on Thursday. We should have time to finish this up, do our market simulation, and I'll see you on Thursday. Study. You got to know all these. All right, who snuck in late?